So, we have a fun-filled day ahead of us with some talking and meditation practice, and I'm particularly interested in hearing what you have to say. I mean, I've been working with this material for a while and have formed some ideas about it, but I'd like to hear how you frame it or what you think of it as it unfolds, so please feel free to comment or ask questions or engage the material. And just a little warning is that some of this can be quite heady. There's a lot of lists and there's certain complexity to it. So as the day goes on, if you find yourself just getting so wrapped up in the ideas or tense or out of the body and in the mind, let's say, just see if you can drop back into the, let the words and the concepts go into the background and be center in the body, you know, because I think that's really what I try and do when I'm studying and working with this material. And if you need a break, you can go for a walk. We'll have some walking periods and more sitting meditation, so we won't be talking the whole day, and we'll have lunch as well. So that's
how's the vault sound? Can you hear okay?
Yeah, as long as the air conditioning is talking.
Because maybe you could just use that.
Would that be better? Just
maybe.
Let's try it.
This bond.
How's this? Any better?
Yep, you're on.
Yeah, and we're also going to record this and we'll post it on the website as well as the slides. Don't feel like you have to take notes. I can convert the slides into a PDF and then as well as a PDF copy of the handout on the website. So, I'm interested in hearing what brings you out today. You know, are you interested in this particular topic of the Abhidhamma, or is this just kind of what you do once a month at the Sangha, or anyone want to say why they're here?
I'm really interested in this topic. I've been looking forward to delving into this a little bit for a while, so thank you for coming today.
You're welcome.
I'm just looking to broaden my understanding of the Dhamma through these teachings. I've been away a little bit, so hope
you can. Okay, thanks. Is anyone here didn't even know this was the topic today? So dropped into this bizarre world, this long word. I'm wondering what the heck is going to happen next. Okay. And as we go on, you can also mention how the material is grabbing you and how you're working with it. So what I thought we would do today is, see if this works, okay, is kind of go over this field, for lack of a better term, of Abhidhamma, what the word means, come at it from different aspects, and kind of discuss it and work with it. I haven't quite, where I first engaged this material was through the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. This is part of Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts, and it's a wonderful kind of branch there. They have their own separate campus in rural Massachusetts where it's led by Andrew Alinsky, who a lot of this material that I'm presenting today comes from. Trying to not have the feedback as much. Not the feedback, but the little... How's this? It's a little better. And they
similar to the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies, which is in the Bay Area that Lori and I belong to, they, at the Berry Center and the Sati Center, really look at study as an integral component of meditation practice. That, you know, you can sit down on the cushion and close your eyes and see what happens, but if you don't really have a framework, either through the body of teachings that are written or given to you orally, it's kind of reinventing the wheel. And most of, you know, when I've tried that in the past, my mind just kind of spins out and I daydream, and, you know, it's not that productive. But if you have kind of a context, and if you can actually do the study and the practice together, it's very helpful. So they have these study retreats at Berry Center, and I've gone there 3 times now and looked at this material, and you know, started reading with it, but I haven't really quite learned how to translate it into meditation practice. So I won't be doing any guided meditations today on Abhidhamma. And I've been told that, you know, where this whole tradition comes out of, that is Asia, specifically started in India, that, and it's still a live practice today. People are Abhidhamists, and they are practicing, you know, not just studying like I'm doing and will be doing today, but they actually use it as a meditative framework. I've been told that these are very advanced practitioners. They're usually monastics, some lay people who have been studying it for many years. And the way they study it is they memorize this vast text, and I'll get into the different layers of the literature. They actually memorize it, and then they develop concentration to these high states of absorption jhana, fourth level of jhana, and then they actually do use this framework to understand, to do insight meditation, basically, in a way that probably we can't fathom, or at least I can't fathom. And there's a teacher that's pretty popular these days in the U.S. called Venerable Pao Auk. He's from Burma. And Burma and Sri Lanka are the main countries that are practicing Abhidhamma these days. But Pao Auk teaches this very, I've been told, you know, kind of sophisticated system where you develop not just the first 4 levels of absorption, but all 8, and then you look at phenomenon experience through the lens of the Abhidhamma. So so what we're doing here is very primitive, I will say, compared to the history of this body of teachings. So kind of these are just kind of the different topics of the day that we'll look at. And then some take-home points, and we'll take these apart over the course of the day, but I just thought it might be good from the get-go to kind of have a framework. Abhidhamma is a word which has a lot of different meanings, but I think the two general meanings are a body of literature that survived, that evolved from the time of the Buddha to still evolving today, and kind of a philosophical and meditative framework and that is still very much a live tradition, and that the Abhidhamma really is an attempt to understand what is happening, our experience of what's happening, on a very detailed, precise way, you know. So the teachings of the Buddha that were, after the Buddha died, were handed down in an oral transmission. There's this, you know, body of knowledge, and I think over time people wanted to systematize that, they wanted to understand it, they wanted to unify it, because, for example, as many of you may know, if you look at afflictive or negative mind states, there's a lot of different ways in the suttas and in the teachings that these are talked about. We have the 5 hindrances is a very common meditator's framework of unwholesome mind states, shall we say. Then we have the 3 unwholesome roots, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion. There's the 10 fetters. There's the blanking out some, but there's all these different lists, and there's certainly some overlap of terms, but one of the things the Abhidhammas try to do is to unify those terms so that you don't have all these lists, that you have one list and you can understand, you know, the unwholesome mind state of greed from, you know, that point.
Jeff, you might want to back up just for some people who may not be familiar with the term of jhana to maybe explain that.
Yeah, sorry, Dick. There's one of the problems I think we might have approaching this material I have with it is there's a lot of technical terms. It's kind of like learning a science or a foreign language, and that sometimes we use an actual foreign language, either Sanskrit or Pali. These are languages that came out of ancient India. And, for example, Abhidhamma is a Pali term, and we might use the word Abhidharma, or we might use the word Dharma, which is a Sanskrit term. So please, if the terminology or there's any questions like the one Lori raised, please, you know, feel free to, you know, comment. We don't want to make this so, I don't know, lofty or inaccessible. You know, there's no dumb question, because all of this can be really complicated and intricate. But to answer Lori's question, I use this term jhana, or meditative absorption, and this is basically a state of mind, body and mind really, where the mind gets so focused, like we all have a sense of concentration if we focus on doing something, but during meditation the mind can get so focused that our senses are no longer engaged, and that the mind is, it's called absorption, is basically absorbed on itself. And this is a very important part of what the Buddha taught, and that people still practice as a way of freeing up the mind. You know, just in general, this is insight meditation, Central Valley. We practice insight meditation or Vipassana, and insight meditation is a way of you know, really understanding our experience, seeing clearly into the nature of our experience. And really, that can't happen without some degree of concentration. And there's this whole controversy of how concentrated the mind needs to be. So, for example, if we're here and there's loud rock and roll music and these, you know, it's flashing these wild scenes on the screen, we'd be very distracted. The mind would just be, you know, kind of overwhelmed with all this information. And it's hard really to see the forest from the trees when we're in that state. On the other hand, when we were practicing just now and we had our eyes closed and we were, you know, whatever practice you were doing, there was some withdrawal from all the external world and some going inward, and that process there involved concentration or a settling of the mind. So just the jhana, or you might hear the term meditative absorption, is whole set of mind states that are so highly refined levels of concentration that it's, I'm not able to speak about it. Maybe some people here could, but their experiential levels and maybe I would even say altered levels of consciousness, where the mind is very purified and settled to deep level. So, what else? One thing that the Abhidhammas did in their processing this material is really kind of tease apart very subtle aspects of the Dharma. Some would argue to the point of was ad nauseum when you kind of dissect things to such a level. And necessarily part of that process was getting into areas of controversy that when the Buddha was teaching said, don't go there. You know, don't spend your time thinking about, you know, what's the meaning of life, where I'm from, where I'm going after I die, you know, these kind of philosophical questions, which I think a lot of us, you know, really, I myself really think are interesting, and I've spent a lot of time pondering that aspect. But the Buddha, on many occasions, said, that's not the question. And we'll get to the question, the key question of life. That's not the question. We'll get to that in a minute. But the Abhidhammas definitely went into that territory. And then it created, I have a slide of the evolution of all this, created
I would say, millennia of scholarly debates, you know, where people were, you know, yelling at each other. Most of the time they weren't, but they were, you know, basically disagreeing on these fine points of philosophy and practice. And this material, as you'll see as the day goes on, can really lend itself to that. So that's just kind of a warning. We have to kind of realize this is just a theory. You know, this is just a framework of engaging. And this last line is very important. We don't really need any of this to enjoy the fruits of meditation practice, to really get reap the benefit from just a little bit to all the way to awakening. I don't think anywhere the Buddha taught that you need to master the Abhidhamma to become awakened or to have some freedom in your life. Now, there are teachers you'll find today that will say, yes, you have to do that, but that's an opinion. And I'm not saying that. You know, I don't believe that personally. Any questions or comments on that?
Yeah. I just have a technical question. Since you're a student of Pali, do you know what the Abhidhamma actually literally translates out as?
Yes, yeah. In fact, I was going to...
Is that a segue?
Yeah, let's use that as a segue. The... and the short answer is, we don't know. There's this word, prefix abhi, and then dhamma. So we know dhamma is this word, and this is the Pali, and I'll try and get out of the way here in a minute. And then you might see abhidharma, and this is spelled as one word. I kind of have a space there, abhidharma, and this is the Sanskrit version. That side of the room. This term dharma is often difficult to translate. It has a lot of different meanings. Or dhamma in Pali, or dharma. So we speak generally in terms of the dharma, that's the teaching of the Buddha. That's probably the most common use of the word. And then it can also mean just things. Things, yeah. Like, there's dharmas on this table, not necessarily the books, or there's just dharmas in this room. There's things in this room. In the Abhidhamma, dhamma takes on a very refined meaning of the basic subunits of experience, and I'll explain that in more detail as the day goes on, but it became a very, I guess I'm going to use the word rarefied, but a very specific use of this term, dhamma. It can also be categories of experience. There's different ways of using it. So this term Abhidhamma first showed up in the suttas, and we're kind of getting ahead of the game a little bit, but I'll talk about the whole framework of Buddhist literature, the Pali canon, the Tipitaka that's come down to us. But this term here was first appeared in the suttas, and it was mentioned in the sense of certain practitioners talking about the Dharma. So this, on a very basic level, abhi means about or around or regarding the Dharma. However, over time, this prefix also can mean higher or superior or, I don't know, advanced. So there's that, and that's probably how it's interpreted today, is that this is the higher teachings, and that's, you know, a matter of opinion, right? But this is higher than the Dharma, and we'll get to what the Dharma is in a minute. I think that's a good starting point. But just the roots of it were, it's about the Dharma. And we'll get into specifically how the whole thing evolved over time.
Jeff, is there a relationship, you know, when you said higher, it made me think of, like, Mahayana.
Well,
is that considered a higher, you know, like in that category of like a larger, greater vehicle?
I think some Abhidhammas throughout the ages have considered that. I don't want to believe that at all. I mean, for me, this is interesting. There's basically the controversy here is there's people who love the Abhidhamma and they think that's the end all, the be all, that that's really the pathway of practice. And then there's, maybe you call them the Sutta purists, you know, so in the whole realm, the people who really base their practice on the suttas and the teaching of the Buddha. And we'll talk, for those of you maybe who don't know the difference, I'll talk about that in a minute. And then there's people who don't believe in any of the historical literature of the Buddha, and they just, they practice based on, modern teachings. You know, we were talking earlier about mindfulness-based stress reduction. That evolved out of all of this, but it's, if you go to an MBSR class, which is really a type of insight meditation used for people with chronic pain or anxiety or different mental and physical ailments, it's a secular or medical model of mindfulness meditation. If you go to that, you'll never hear anything about a sutta or even the Buddha. It's very framed in a very kind of accessible language for medical centers and therapists and very secular. So you mentioned Mahayana, Lori, and Mahayana means greater vehicle. So as Buddhism evolved after the time of the Buddha, there was a lot of controversies, and the Abhidharma was really at the heart of all of this. And as I mentioned earlier, straight into territories that the Buddha said should better be left unanswered or unpondered, really. And there's this whole body, and the Mahayanas didn't evolve just in response to the Abhidhammas, but part of what they were doing is trying to bring the practice back into back into the heart, back into it was an attempt to weave in what the Buddha taught, or what we had recollection of what the Buddha taught, with this whole teachings around emptiness. So we'll talk a little bit about the Sarvastivada. This was one of the schools that evolved. This school has come down the lineage of the Theravada. So there were the different schools that evolved after the time of the Buddha, partially due to doctrinal disagreements and differences, and partially due to geographic separation. People spread out from this place in central India where the Buddha lived and taught and died. These different schools evolved, and they were geographically separated, and the schools were basically monastics, monks and nuns who were carrying on the teachings, who were doing the practice, and their whole life, like any religious order, was centered around this. And they were in different parts of Asia, and so they developed different there's a whole set of vinyas, a whole set of rules. They would evolve different fine points of vinyas, and then there were these controversies and schisms, and whole thing has evolved now, so you might hear of Zen or Tibetan schools of meditation practice, and those are Mahayana, and then another one is Theravada. So I don't want to stray too far into that, but definitely the part of the evolution of Mahayana was a reaction to specifically the Sarvastivada Abhidhammists who went straight back into this belief that things exist, and we'll get into this definitely with the Theravada, that there's this concreteness, a solidity to experience on a subunit level. And they said, no, that's not true, everything is empty. You might hear that expression if you hang out with the Mahayanists, all is empty. But I don't want to go too far into all of that. Let's move on with our Abhidhamma. What else? So another way of looking at this material is breaking things down into their subunit components. And the Abhidhamma is a way of taking 28 physical factors, combining them with 52 mental factors, to develop 89 distinct states of consciousness that is experienced in 17 discrete moments of experience and has 24 ways of relating of those different moments of consciousness. So that's what we're up against here today. Having said that, you probably all want to leave. And we, you know, I don't know if anyone would ever know all of those different, you know, that matrix of different experience, but that's how detailed this system evolved to. That's the degree. Yes?
You just said, I don't know that anybody would know all these experiences or mind states or consciousness. Is that the same as we all may have experienced them but not been aware enough to be conscious of them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's maybe the key question here is, so we're here having experience, and the question is, to what level are we aware of what that experience is? You know, I mean, that's what the whole process of meditation is to understand our experience. And this is one framework of doing it, but just on a very basic level, how much of what's happening in our mind are we aware of? And a practical example is, let's say we're sitting here meditating during one of our periods, and then suddenly the thought of lunch comes up, and, you know, I can get off to the races, you know, okay, what's lunch? Why, I'm really hungry. You know, I wonder if the, you know, that sandwich I have in my lunchbox is, you know, going to taste good. And, oh, I forgot the lettuce. You know, there's this whole proliferation that happens. Meanwhile, all of this other stuff is happening that I'm not aware of. So really the key problem, you know, from the sense of Buddhist psychology and from all this is ignorance that, you know, our minds aren't developed, you know, our states of concentration, our ability to see experience aren't developed enough, so that most of our experience passes us by or we miscomprehend it. And this is kind of the bad news in Buddhism, the hard pill to swallow, and some of you, please feel free to disagree or, you know, to hold this as an open question, but from the perspective of awakening and Buddhism, not, you know, to put up Abhidhamma aside for a moment, the problem is we are ignorant of some basic facts about life, and then we misperceive our experience and don't understand it. And because of that, we suffer. We have we experience pain and suffering. That's kind of the theory of all this in a nutshell.
So if we are on a trajectory of awakening, all memory can be false because our consciousness, our state of consciousness at that time, is just false awareness in that moment, experience.
Yes, and actually psychology, not Buddhist psychology, Western psychology, who study memory, know that the memory is false. I mean, a lot of the way we remember things, we put things together, we kind of summarize things in a very different way. So most of our memories have a certain degree, in fact, a great degree of inaccuracy to them. But yeah, specifically, I think what you're saying is that from this trajectory of becoming more and more awake, earlier times in our practice, we had more and more delusion guiding our, you know, we're more under the influence of the three unwholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so, yeah, we could look back. And that's why it's best not to project out to the future or live in the past. Not that, you know, you can't do those things. I mean, we need a certain amount of planning and a certain amount of recollection of where we've been. But when we spend a lot of time in those realms, it's just not productive because the memory is inaccurate. We don't know what the future holds. Thank you. Great questions. So that was the mathematical approach of what's going on here. And we'll roll through each of those. We're not going to look at all 28 factors, physical factors, and all 52. We'll look, they're on the handout, and we'll kind of look at them in a broad category and, you know, just kind of see how they're actually applied. But we won't... So one thing I wrote down here is this is an atomistic view of experience. So an atom is, I think we all know, in the physical world is the basic, one of the basic seven units. Now it turns out there's subatomic particles. If we have time at the end of the day, I'm going to talk about how quantum physics and looking at subatomic particles really maps well to the Abhidhamma. That is, if we have time. But the Abhidhamma is an atomistic or a reductionist view of experience. One of the early translators of Pali, a British Protestant living in Sri Lanka, India and Sri Lanka, in the 1800s, Carolyn Rhys Davids, who and her husband did a lot of translations, she called the Abhidhamma the Buddhist psychological ethics. So Buddhist psychological ethics, it's psychology, the study of the mind. And there's this ethical component, and I think that's a very key element. This isn't just a dry intellectual exercise. There's a point to it, and the point of it is, we're going to look at ethics. The basic subunit of ethics in Buddhism, I would argue, is what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. And it's not in kind of this chaste, puritanical sense of wholesome. Another way of looking at it is what is skillful or what is healthy. Some of the other behaviors that we do in our life are very are healthy. We take care of ourselves, we're kind to each other, practice meditation. And some of them aren't. Some people in our society have addictions, there's violence, there's, sometimes we say things that are very harmful. So really the balance here of all action, and not just in an Abhidhamma sense, but in a Buddhist sense, is this ethical component of what is skillful and what is unskillful.
Jeff, just a point of clarification here. Are we talking wholesome, unwholesome relative to right view in terms of that's the criteria by which wholesome, unwholesome are characterized?
Yeah, that would, you could even break it down more simplistic to what's harming and what's non-harming, Really, my understanding of it, it's that, we want to get progressively more non-harming. And, that's a negative framing of the word. Beneficial would be a positive way to put that. So one other thing that's really integral to all of this is to understand that our experience is kinetic, that what we experience in our life is not a solid stationary thing. Like we look at these physical objects as kind of a permanence, lasting, enduring entity. Now, we all know we're going to die and this thing will rust and degrade. But the way we are getting to the question of ignorance, the way we misperceive it is we take it as a solid entity. And from the get-go, I think it's very helpful, just in general from practice, but specifically with the Abhidhamma, is to see things as events, as happenings, occurrences in time, rather than solid entities. Some teachers talk about saying that there are nouns and verbs, verbs and action, and the noun is, a person, place, or a thing. And one of my teachers, Lee Brasington, said there are no nouns, they're just very slow-moving verbs, So this is a verb that was, heard. And I don't know, it was stardust at some point, right? Developing the solar system. And then it was mined and refined and manufactured and turned into this, and then it'll rust and fall apart, end up in landfill and return to this, matter. So if we can really see ourselves as transient processes rather than concrete things, it really goes a long way. And this really maps to science, how science understands things, that matter really has a, you've heard of the wave-particle duality, that matter is not really solid, but it also has this element of electromagnetic, of a movement of energy and time, and that if you look at things on a very subatomic level, there is, even though this is hard and if I hit it, I can hurt myself, most of this is empty space. Most of this is energy occupying space at a very rapid rate, and that it has a sense of solidity, but if you really see what's happening, it's 99.999% empty space. It's really hard to get, you know, looking at it, but that is the science that tells us that's what's happening there. And quantum physics looks at how to map those particles and understand where they are and how they interact, and that's what Abhidhamma does on a grosser level, on a higher level. And this maps to neuroscience too. So we don't know what consciousness is. This is kind of the, I think it's Stephen Pinker, some famous neuroscientist has called it the hard problem. How do you get from what consciousness is, what we experience, our experience, to what the brain is? You know, how does consciousness map onto the brain? We have no clue. I mean, we've mapped areas of the brain, we've looked at it microscopically, we understand these neurons interacting, but we don't really know how it all works. And maybe within our lifetime there'll be some progress on that. There is a lot of progress, but on an experiential event level, this is how our consciousness works. We have, I believe, some firing of neurons, and neurons are these very small cells in the body that have lots of connections, I think on the order of several hundred billion or a trillion, some, you know, unfathomable number, and that when there's an area of the brain that's activated, there will be firing of the neurons, neurotransmitters will be released, and then that process will stop, and other processes will occur. So it's like a wave. You know, if you're in a stadium and you have this kind of wave, it's the same thing in the brain. There'll be an area of the brain that's activated. Maybe there's a thought, or, you know, your visual cortex right now is taking in photons and activating your visual cortex, which is in the back here. And there's this, you know, if you think about what has to happen with the eye, all of these particles of light are processed through the eye, through the different nerves, and then into the neurocortex, and then it goes out from there so that we might think about it or act upon it. But there's this amazing, you know, biochemical experience that happens, and then in a moment it's something else. You know, maybe you're hearing a sound. So there's this kind of transient, flowing, constant stream of experience, and the Abhidhamma tries to dissect that to a level of very fine detail that probably, without those really high levels of concentration, probably the human mind can't perceive in the moment. And I'll talk a little bit later about the time scale of this, how quickly this happens. It blows the mind away. And we know the neurons fire very quickly. We know that light travels at this amazing speed, but the biological processes don't happen at that speed of light. Okay, what else do we want to do now? So that was just a little humor on, I wonder what happened in the next slide. this is maybe another warning about engaging this material to such a degree. And then this just says, basically what we think are to be the foundation of the teaching is doing no harm, engaging in what's skillful or beneficial, and purifying one's mind, which allows us to do the first two better, more skillfully. You know, right? In our Dharma practice, we learn what doesn't work, you know, and especially on things I like to look at, you know, speech with my partner, for example.
I learned from a Dharma perspective, oh, when I say X, Y happens. You know, it's the cause of the relationship. So this time, hopefully I get more skillful. So here's the Dharma. Before we get into the Abhidhamma, this is really central to practice, and this just kind of teases out that skillful, unskillful that we're talking about in a little bit more detail. So we know that the first noble truth of Buddha is that dukkha exists, that there's suffering. Sometimes dukkha is translated as unsatisfactoriness. You know, because sometimes, you know, we don't really see that there's any suffering. You know, we might be comfortable. But there's just this kind of not quite okay with things is that we commonly experience. And, you know, a lot of it we don't see. We don't realize we're not satisfied with things since this passes by. And then that the cause of this dukkha really is that this craving that we attach to things, that we want things to be a certain way. We, you know, and we know this, we gravitate towards things that are pleasant and away from things that are unpleasant. Kind of like an amoeba. You take an amoeba in a petri dish there and you put down some salt, which is considered noxious and irritating. It'll migrate away from the salt. But if you put down sugar there, it'll migrate towards the sugar. And this is kind of how our minds are hardwired. You know, we gravitate towards pleasant events. If something's hot, you know, we get away from it. Or if it's something is good to eat or a pleasant experience, we latch onto it. That's very basic survival. We need that skill. However, it also, I think, if you, you know, once you really start to examine what's happening, it's the greatest source of, you know, what we experience is painful or difficult. That when we engage everything in this way, we shut off a big part of our experience, and that we also are constantly disappointed. Because why? Because things don't last. You know, if I really love this heater in this room and really need it, you know, someday it's going to break down and not work, and I'm going to be frustrated. That's kind of a very simple example. Now, this whole concept, this dukkha, like everything else, is impermanent. So one way or another, the dukkha you experience in any given moment is going to cease. And if you want to aid that process of cessation, the fourth noble truth is that there's a way of practice that we can do, eight practical things that we can cultivate that will help us to lead to the cessation of dukkha. And so each one of these is not just a philosophy in the way the Buddha taught them, they actually have it's actually instructions or tasks. And so we're dukkha, we want to understand it. We really want to see it. You know, we want to work on that ignorance part by getting in there and seeing, okay, this is dukkha in my life. This is dukkha in the moment. Seeing it over and over again, really understanding it. And part of that is understanding the craving that's behind, that's underneath the dukkha, getting to the craving. And so the task of the first is to understand it. The second is to abandon that craving. See the craving if you can. Sometimes it's really hard to do, right? If we're really attached to something, really addicted to the way things should be. But to set that intention and to try and abandon, you know, and it's a, you know, momentary battle that we're struggling with. Cessation of dukkha is to be achieved or realized. Some would say to be let go of, you know, so the way you realize cessation of dukkha is to see the craving and then to abandon that craving, to let go of it in that moment, and then you will experience cessation of your dukkha. And then the Noble Eightfold Path, really, that's what we do. I mean, we spent 30 minutes this morning meditating. That's, you know, part of the path. There's a whole, I think I took out the slide on the Eightfold Path, which is unfortunate, but I think we're a little bit behind, so we won't go into that too far. Otherwise, this would be a big long and painful path and be heading them. Any questions on that? So this is the Dharma. You know, I think this is a good ground to then look at the about the Dharma or the higher Dharma, however you want to put it.
And so let's look at all the, let's look at what we have surviving today. The literature that came from the time of the Buddha. Now, so who here's heard of the Pali Canon? Yeah, many people. So we talked about Pali is this language coming out of ancient India, and Canon is, you know, a collection. Sometimes it's called the Tipitapa, Tipitaka, which is, that's Pali term again, here we go technical again, is, means, three baskets or three collections of teaching. So, these are available, a lot of this now in translation in English, but this, starting from after the time of the Buddha, evolved into this, you know, massive body of teachings. And then there's spin-offs of all of it, but getting to the basics. So a lot of what we study and learn, like let's say we go on a retreat, or if you come here and we're teaching mindfulness or whatever, a lot of that has come out of the suttas right here. So that's one of the baskets. And the suttas you can break down into some further categories. The Digha-Nikaya long discourses, the middle length, this is an English translation by Bhikkhus Nathanamoli and Bodhi, that's very, you know, so this gives you an idea of how much volume of literature, this is kind of an average size. So we're talking huge amounts of data or pages or books. That's Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses. And by the way, sutta, this Pali term, you can translate it as discourses, and a discourse is a kind of discrete teaching of the Buddha.
Well, sutta equals sutra?
Yes, thank you very much. Yeah, sutra is the Sanskrit.
More common in English?
You know, in this tradition, we use sutta, but you'll probably hear sutra more common. And then sutra.
The same thing.
What's that?
It's the same.
Yes, exactly. You use them interchangeably, and you there are bad. This is all the Theravadan canon. The Mahayana have another one, and there's far more Mahayana sutras, you know, because that's a Sanskrit tradition, the Mahayana, than there are suttas here. So we can use them interchangeably. Sometimes sutra means Mahayana and sutta means Theravada, but there's a lot of overlap with that. Not everyone sticks to that designation.
And you'll also hear the term Yoga Sutras, which is different too. So just to understand that there's different categories of sutras.
Yeah, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali are not Buddhist. I mean, we think they borrowed heavily from the Eightfold Path and some of the teachings of the Buddha, but there are sutras, Yoga Sutras, and they're it's more of a Hindu yoga tradition. Very confusing, right? then there's more books here, and this fifth category has broken down into many other books. Probably many of you know about the Dhammapada, or maybe you've heard of the Jataka tales of the Buddha, various categories here. So this is one of the baskets, the suttas, and then the other basket was the Vinaya, which is the rules that were established at the time of the Buddha for the monastic order, the monks and the nuns, and the stories on how they those rules came into being. So they're very interesting stories on how the different people, you know, made mistakes or, you know, exploited various things, and then the Buddha said, no, we can't do that anymore. Here's a new rule for you. And in the Theravada tradition, there's 227 rules for monks, and 312, I believe, for nuns. So but I'm sad to say that Buddhism is a misogynistic religion, like many in this world. Maybe misogynistic, well, at times misogynistic, but certainly not equal. And so there were more rules for nuns, and I'll just stop there. Opinions about all that, but there's been some scholarly work by a monk named Niku Inalio, who's from Germany, and he's really gone back and looked at, you know, the theme of misogyny and how nuns were accused of various, and there's a number of scholars who have done this. Bhikkhu Bodhi is another one, and really believes that the Buddha wasn't misogynistic, and that a lot of this came, you know, from the monastics, not from the male monks after the time of Buddha, and that there's some, I would say, additions or manipulations of this particular area here at the Vinaya. Because we have different Vinayas from other traditions, and the Theravada one in particular is very, again, I think misogynistic is maybe too specific, but it is impressive, chauvinistic, yes, that would. Why don't you tap that?
No,
that's fine. Okay. Oh, you know what happened? Is I forgot to plug in
Yeah.
We had a power cord here somewhere. Technical difficulties, please stand by. Any comments or anything at this point about we're looking at the Tipitaka, the suttas, and the Vinaya for two of the baskets. Yes?
Are all of the books of the Abhidhamma in that comprehensive manual?
Yeah, we'll get to this in a minute. That's a good question. The question was, are all of the books of the Abhidhamma in here? And the answer is no. And we'll get to exactly what this is. This is, if you went to the library or you went online and you said, this is interesting stuff. I want to read a book about the Abhidhamma. This would probably be the best seller of that category. I'm not saying it's the most accessible. It is a place that is kind of dry. It's also fascinating. But what this is the Abhidhammata Sangaha. I think I've got to read with that. A comprehensive manual of Abhidhamma. And what this is, actually this was written, I think what I'll do, I've got to explain the whole thing, how the literature evolved. This is written way after the Abhidhamma or developed. And so, but this is what they study in Burma. This is, if you take a class in Abhidhamma, when I took that course in the Berry Center, this is what they use as a text. But this is basically a Cliff Notes version of the Abhidhamma. It's well digested and very accessible compared to the Pitaka. Let's see here if I can get this one. Thanks, Lori, for plugging it in. So the third basket is the Abhidhamma. And we think that the Buddha didn't teach the Abhidhamma. So the way history records this is that after the Buddha lived and taught, and after he died, there was a gathering of all the monks and nuns. In ancient India, within a few months of his passing, and they said, okay, now the Buddha's dead, what are we going to do? And they said, let's first of all agree upon what he taught, you know, and so we can pass that on to later generations so the Dharma would exist. And this was all kind of the plan all along. So they sat down and they didn't have any writing in those days. They didn't have any PowerPoint presentations. It was an old translation. They started saying, okay, this is what I remember him saying. And so a lot of the suttas will begin, this is what I heard, or this is how I heard it. That's the opening line to many of the suttas. And then one monk would recite it, or none, and then the others would say, yeah, that's right. Or they might say, oh no, I think you got this part wrong. And they agreed upon what it would be. And then from there, these generations of monastics started all day long reciting these texts in their heads, and then they repeat periodically and do it verbally so they would preserve the teachings. It's an amazing system, and it wasn't unique to Buddhism. This is how the Vedas, some of you may have heard of the Vedas and the Upanishads, those were all also literature from ancient India that were transmitted orally. So it was part of the culture at the time. They didn't have TVs and radios and podcasts, so what I think people would do is just recite and spread the Dharma that way. Now, you can imagine with that system that there's always possibility for error. We kind of think of when we write a letter or, a document or email, that that's going to be transmitted, with 100% fidelity. Now, of course, oftentimes we see a little error there when we go back and read it later, but with the oral transmission, that puts it at risk of some transmission errors. We think it was very well transmitted, but there's definitely, there's a whole body of scholarship looking at the transmission errors and comparing different versions of texts to see what was really taught. So, after the Buddha died, the Sangha got together and they agreed upon these two. There wasn't a Tipitaka. And the order of the organization of this was different at the time. This is basically, with this vast volume of text, this was just is a convenient way of grouping all of the suttas of a middle length into this one volume, and all of the long ones in this volume. And this is thematic. So all of the Noble Eight Suttas about Noble Eightfold Path or the Five Aggregates are here. This is numerical, so there's all these lists in Buddhism. So there are different ways of cutting up the pie, and this is how it evolved. But at the beginning, it was just this massive amount of information that Buddha had left behind. And another problem with all of this is the ancient Indians were not into history like we are, right? And if you study European history, you get exact dates, you have all different references of what happened in 1867, for example. That wasn't the case then. They didn't record things in terms of time like that. So there's some controversy of exactly, for example, when the Buddha was born and when he died. There's been many academic articles on that. So, but we do have some recordings, especially through the Sri Lankan school, the Theravada school, that at the time of the Buddha, the first council was meeting in Lusindana. There was only the Vinaya Pitaka and the Sutta Pitaka, and that this Abhidhamma, subject of today, developed later, within the first 200 or 300 years of the Buddha's death. Now, the traditional Theravada party line is the Buddha developed the Abhidhamma, so he got awakened under the Bodhi tree, and he spent 7 weeks there further developing the Dharma before he went out to teach it. And on the fourth week, he did Abhidhamma. He came up with this advanced system. And then 7 years later, some number of years later, he transmigrated to the Tathagatamsa heaven, where his mother had died and was reborn as a deva, and he taught it to her in this audience of devas, this Abhidhamma, and every day he would go, because he was human in this heavenly realm, he would go down to earth and meet with Sariputta, one of his main disciples, and tell him what he had taught that day, and then Sariputta would transmit it to these monks. This is the legend of the Abhidhamma, of where it comes from, in the Theravadan traditional account. And so because of that framework, it has the Abhidhamma has come down to us associated with Sariputta. There are several suttas that he spoke or about him that are very kind of, we can see Abhidhamma prototypes or precursors, and you can kind of see why he would be associated. And then, maybe you could argue people backfilled in this legend to fit with him as the figure. Not so puffy. But I think most scholars think that basically the Buddha died. We had a bunch of monks and nuns sitting around, you know, reciting this, thinking about it, practicing with it. We really believe the Abhidhamma developed in the early days as a meditation, I don't know, psychology, as a meditation system. So not just a dry theoretical framework, which over time it's evolved into, but as a way of actually understanding that experience on a very micro, detailed level. And there's certain evidence for that. So the Abhidhamma have these seven books here, and we'll go into those in a minute. And so at a certain point, so this was all oral, and at a certain point it was written down. So writing half of the whole Pali Canon, the Tipitaka, happened about the time of Christ. And this was written down in Sri Lanka in the Pali language, Theravada, in this lineage, and then also in different Sanskrit versions around that time as well. Unfortunately, I think most of you know that Buddhism thrived, flourished, and then passed away in India over the course of 1500 years. And there was, you know, this vast empire of schools of men, monks and nuns and lay people like us practicing with it, learning it, studying it, transmitting it. And then it came to an end, and now it had migrated out to south to Sri Lanka, and then eventually to Burma, Thailand, and Southeast Asia for the Theravada school, and up north to what's now Afghanistan, Central Asia, China, Tibet, Japan, and Korea for Mahayana schools. And so it really became a living religion in other parts of Asia, but it was kind of on the way out, and then the Muslim invasions of around 1000 Common Era, so 1000 AD, pretty much wiped it out completely. And there's a lot of destruction of the text, so a lot was lost to history. The Pali Canon survived because it was in Sri Lanka, and that had been protected. And it was in writing, and then, you know, what they wrote on in those days was palm leaves, and palm leaves, like the Buddha and everything else in us, are impermanent, you know, maybe less so than stone tablets or digital devices. So they had to retranscribe the suttas, the different aspects of the text every, you know, 80 years or so. But they managed to maintain it up to this time. And then it was translated from the Sri Lankan script of Pali into different other languages, Burmese. There's a Roman script that you can, you know, there's scholars can read it. The Dhamma, the terms I wrote up there, that's Roman script in Pali. And then you can translate that into other languages, English, French, Spanish, and modern languages. So if you buy a book like this, a collection of 152 suttas, it is in English translated from Roman script to Pali. Actually, the way Bhikkhu Bodhi did, I think he knew the other language as well, because there's some discrepancies. So it's, you know, there's all these levels of translation, you know, through time and space from what the Buddha taught to what we have access to today. So that's always kind of a caveat to understand with this. Now, it is 10:30. We've been sitting down here for about an hour and a half. And I think this would be a good time for, there's no burning question, maybe a walking session to... I think it's helpful with this to kind of drop it every now and then and just, you know, get back into the body. And we'll do that formally today with some periods of walking and sitting. So why don't we walk, since it's probably still a beautiful day out. And then I'll go around and ring a bell at 11 o'clock, and we'll start up again with another sitting period.